This may come as a surprise to you. It's never easy for me to risk opening my mouth and to say anything. You have heard me say things over and over again, and I'm sure some of you have said to yourself, why does he persist the way he does? I did not speak early on in my life. I was nearly five before I started talking, and some would suggest I've been playing catch up. Others would be quick to say, I think he's ahead now. Our lectionary scripture lesson for the day is Luke's account of Jesus beginning his public ministry by going back home to his hometown, Nazareth. And there, reading the Hebrew scripture lection for the day, and after his reading, states that the scriptural admonition is being fulfilled in him. Boom. And we know the rest of the story as it is compiled in the other three, or the three gospel accounts. Jesus' townies think, well, maybe he's off his meds, needs to see a shrink. I mean, how could he be so narcissistic, disrespect tradition the way he just has? And then they start throwing rocks, let you know what they're thinking. Any scene that you've seen on television of the Palestinian protests reminds you that the geology of that area has provided lots and lots of rocks, and they are the weapon most available to the average citizen. Jesus ducks, scurries out of town, and to the best of our knowledge, he never returns to his home. Now, by the time I got around yesterday to finishing my thoughts about the sermon, It was too late. It was too late to have our choir sing the anthem by John Mellencamp, Small Town. Though we probably could hum our way through most of it because it has become the second best state song since Back Home Again in Indiana. Well, I was born in a small town. I live in a small town. Probably I'll die in a small town. Oh, those small communities. All my friends are in a small town. My parents live in the same small town. My job is so small town. Provides little opportunity, hey? Educated in a small town. Taught to fear Jesus in a small town. There's a theological thing to ponder. Used to daydream in that small town. Another born romantic, that's me, but I've seen it all in a small town. Oh, that's good enough for me. Well, I was born in a small town. I can breathe in a small town, going to die in a small town, and that's probably where they will bury me. So with apologies to Mr. Mellencamp, who I don't think is here today, I think both our official state anthem and his song, Small Town, carry the emotional weight of our current national divide concerning what it means to make America great again. Because while the rich get richer and the poor only poor, we are left to fight battles over nostalgic memories rather than solve centuries-old conflicts. And that's what Jesus was doing in the reading this morning. He was riding his movement, if you will, into Nazareth to announce that he was finally going to right the wrongs that have been happening to his people, their government, their religion. What happened last weekend in Washington, D.C., which I trust many of us have seen just sprayed all over all forms of social media, about that 14-year-old Catholic schoolboy, the 69-year-old Native American Vietnam War veteran is right out of the pages of our Holy Bibles. Jesus bringing his movement into Nazareth, later riding into Jerusalem on a donkey with crowds chanting his arrival as a Messiah who has finally come to liberate the people from the tyrannies of oppressive politics and religion. He's going to clean up the swamp. And we should be, and many of us are, haunted by the similarities. The other group, incidentally, present in Washington, D.C., that is barely mentioned, but could be, in my mind, the most likely fuse to have ignited the situation, were the black Hebrew Israelites who taunted the Catholic schoolboys. The Louisville public relations firm Runswitch, the Louisville Courier-Journal reported this week, they issued a statement that the African-American protester called the students, and I quote, "faggots and children of incest," end quote. Jesus's religious and political situation was dangerous and every bit as potentially explosive as that moment on the mall in Washington, D.C., as white Catholic boys, Native Americans, and black Hebrew Israelites gathered in Washington, D.C. to make their political statements. In the midst of a national protest against women's rights to be in control of their own bodies. It was a rancorous, emotionally charged event. And I want you to remember it when we finally get to Palm Sunday. And Jesus is parading in Jerusalem during Passover. There were as many groups then as today. And the passions and the confusions were every bit as present. If you do not know about the black Hebrew Israelite group, I guess I don't blame you. It's not easy to stay up to date on the many subgroups that exist in our culture. It's a group that's been in existence since the 1800s, and they claim to be the true Jews. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which was founded by civil rights attorneys in the 1970s to fight racism, white supremacist groups, and to protect people from discrimination, they list that organization, the Black Hebrew Israelites, as a hate group. The director of that civil rights organization's project, as they track domestic extremists, said the obscure movement's followers promote hate against Jewish, gay, and white people. In many ways, she added, they are a mirror image of white groups that hate blacks. Now, the reason that I'm wading through this current event material is because women and men of faith must be aware of the facts so that our faith, our spirituality, if you will, can be found and experienced as credible. We must be in full interplay with the events of our time, or else I think our faith is wasted. And we're found useless in the eyes of those who are seeking a way through the haze and the maze of complexities that name our lives here in the first quarter of the 21st century. Never has a need for more centered spirituality been demanded than right now. The demands for a grounded faith is now, and we must not shrink back from being the leaders that our children, our grandchildren, our neighbors deserve from us. Yes, it's complicated with power politics plowing roughshod over so many of our lives, and especially so the most vulnerable. Popular religion continues unabated to lust for political power connections with the rich and the powerful rather than commit themselves to living the way of Jesus of Nazareth. And to my way of thinking and believing, it has never been a more rich time to be progressively engaged with clear and concise theological alternatives to the lazy mainstream of church and culture. Jesus gives us this morning his purpose statement. He gave us that which we need to carry with us in our wallets, in our shirt pockets, to pull out as a ready reference. Each of us should know this one by heart. If you were going to memorize one scriptural lection to lay beside each happening in our lives and culture to help guide our way, it would be this one. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. For Luke's Jesus, this is the reason for being. And those of us who dare call ourselves followers of the way of Jesus, our Christ, it is our mission statement as well. And please remember to understand the wider metaphors of what it means for the blind to see and to release captives. It's not about physically blind people and the folks jailed for crimes against whatever. There are hundreds of thousands who yet cannot see the greater truths. And there are equal numbers oppressed, not only by small ideas and rather ridiculous religious concepts, but economically and politically, so many of us are oppressed in our culture. I thought last week was a huge learning moment for those of us who are easily swayed by the outrage du jour. It was a sin, I think, for the Covington Catholic kids to make fake tomahawk chants and do that thing that they do when Omaha leader Nathan Phillips was beating his drum. I thought it was a sin, I thought it was bad for the black Hebrew Israelite sidewalk preachers to taunt the Catholic kids with homophobic slurs. I think it was also a sin for people to make death threats against the kid, smirking in that photo, and for people to project character qualities into that facial expression. I was a kid once, and I did a lot of that, I'm afraid. It was also a sin, I thought, for journalists to jump recklessly on the story whose full complexity was unknown in order to get the scoop and score the most hits. It was also a sin, I thought, for right-wing pundits to assassinate the character of Nathan Phillips in order to achieve their agenda of making the Covington Catholic kids into martyr heroes and turning every national drama into a referendum on political correctness. I didn't see anything that Nathan Phillips did that was obviously wrong, though I don't think he recognized the degree to which the boys had been baited by those street preachers, and they were 14. Since he has been the most humble voice in all of this nonsense, I suspect he could probably think of something he could have done better. And in the midst of all that ugly noise, there are many real people saying valid, truthful things and calling out real ugliness. It is true that white liberal pundits will throw anybody under the bus who they need in order to give themselves that higher moral ground of being objective and fair. And I have been guilty of that. It is true that some people are privileged enough to have an expensive PR firm ghostwrite a public statement for them that turns public sympathy their way, which doesn't mean that hiring a PR firm is an unreasonable thing to do if you're getting death threats and people trying their best to ensure that you're expelled from high school and blacklisted from every college that you ever applied to because you smirked and did not step aside in a crushing, confusing moment that you didn't know really what to do, and he did what he did. These truths are not swept aside by the recognition that our disembodied, sensationalist social media discourse can create a toxic mess that ruins people's lives. And saying that lives can be ruined by social media cannot cancel out the lives that would be ruined without it, or the political empowerment that is gained through it. It is not a zero-sum game. I need to remember that almost every day, but it's so important to our humanity to say it over and over again. This isn't a zero-sum game that we're involved in right now. People get hurt on social media. People get abused. Political, cultural, religious conflict hurts. It can even kill people. And I think the real insidious evil is that billions of dollars are being made off the hysteria that we all get baited into. Outrage is incentivized over actual, thoughtful political organizing and cultural and religious education, because outrage makes money, and it's a quick and easy way to indulge in it like it is just going home at the end of a day and have a beer or a glass of wine. It's very hard, I find, as a preacher, not to get sucked in to the outrage, which is why I think we need to keep our purpose front and center. Our reason for being who we are as we struggle to be found as people of faith. We have to pay attention. We also need to forgive, while also boldly stand forward for the people who need stood up for. In my hometown, not so much different than Shipshawana, we stood up for us, our neighbors, our friends, our associates, whether we should have or not. Well, we did it, at least publicly. We talked about them behind their backs. We stood mainly to protect our way of life, our honor, our reputations as small-town people. Today, I find myself preferring to stand for those who need fairness and justice, liberty. I prefer to stand for better and fuller and more complete public and religious education and civic duty while not excluding those in other places who have not had the opportunities that I have had. I try to recognize my privilege and use it not to insulate myself from broader, more ugly realities, but use it to bring broader equality and justice to others. And you know, you listen to me with some degree of regularity, I assume, that I spend a lot of time talking about white, straight, privilege, and against homophobia and racism and blind nationalism, because I just discover I must, if I am to risk ever being found to be a man of faith. But I kind of wonder, who do you stand for? Who do you stand for that needs you? I think God is asking. I'm really rather convinced of it.